Today's Monday, May 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United States opens its Israeli embassy in Jerusalem as deadly protests rage in Gaza.
There are huge protests all over the Gaza Strip, and at these protests, there was a considerable amount of violence.
The U.S. warns its European allies about cooperating with the government of Iran, and Australia boosts its efforts to protect koala bears. It's all ahead. On Monday, the United States officially moved its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Meanwhile, at least 52 Palestinians were killed and hundreds wounded in clashes with Israeli forces along the Gaza Strip's border with the Jewish state. Around 100 kilometers from the violent protests, U.S. and Israeli officials gathered in Jerusalem as the embassy was opened. President Donald Trump defied the sentiment of many governments around the world last December and upended long-standing U.S. policy to move the embassy from Tel Aviv, where most nations still have missions in Israel. Trump's daughter Ivanka, who is a senior White House advisor, declared the embassy open.
On behalf of the 45th President of the United States of America, we welcome you officially and for the first time to the Embassy of the United States here in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. Thank you.
Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is a White House advisor and also part of the U.S. delegation. He spoke at the ceremony.
While presidents before him have backed down from their pledge to move the American embassy once in office, this president delivered. Because when President Trump makes a promise, he keeps it.
Trump spoke at the ceremony by pre-recorded video.
Almost immediately after declaring statehood in 1948, Israel designated the city of Jerusalem as its capital. The capital the Jewish people established in ancient times. So important. Today, Jerusalem is the seat of Israel's government. It is the home of the Israeli legislature and the Israeli Supreme Court and Israel's prime minister and president. Israel is a sovereign nation with the right, like every other sovereign nation, to determine its own capital.
But Arab leaders condemn the U.S. action, with Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri calling the embassy move provocative and Iranian Foreign Minister Javid Zarif describing it as a day of great shame. Protests against the embassy opening raged in Gaza. Thousands of demonstrators gathered, and Gazan health officials said at least 500 people had been injured, including dozens by gunfire. The deaths bring the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces during 6 weeks of protests to more than 60. VOA Middle East correspondent Heather Murdoch is in the Gaza Strip, and she describes to me the unrest there.
Well, today were some of the biggest protesters that people on the ground told me they had seen in a long time. There were huge protests all over the Gaza Strip, and at these protests, there was a considerable amount of violence. Young men and boys were rushing the fences surrounding the Gaza Strip. And in response, Israeli authorities were throwing tear gas. From early in the morning, they were throwing tear gas to disperse the crowds. And when that didn't work and the young men and boys were rushing the fence, there was also gunfire. Just a few minutes ago, we heard some bombs go off and we're told that those were bombs that fell further inside the Gaza Strip, not at protesters, but about security sites inside the Gaza Strip.
And apparently a number of businesses and schools in the Gaza Strip have been closed today.
Yeah, most everything is closed. I mean, there are some restaurants and hotels and stuff open, but regular businesses, schools, universities, they're all closed today. The people who are out and about were mostly at the protest. At the moment, things are starting to disperse as authorities have asked civilians to go home because so many people have been killed or injured already.
Is there enough medical care for those who have been wounded?
I'm not sure how there could be enough medical care, but I'm not sure. I do know at the front lines during the protests, especially when there was, when there was some breach in the fences, there was ambulances rushing in, taking out injured or killed protesters. And it was not very long before they ran out of ambulances and people were lifting injured people on stretchers or in their arms and running out of the protests with them to the hospitals.
And why has this move, moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, why is that so controversial for the Palestinians?
Well, for 70 years since Israel was created, Jerusalem has not been recognized as the capital of Israel by the international community as a move to keep the peace, because it is a holy city that is considered the most holy city by people of Muslim and Christian and Jewish faith, so of all three. So to recognize this city as the capital of Israel is to recognize it as the capital of the Jewish faith. And Muslims here are telling me that it's not. It's a city for everybody, and their most holy sites are there, too.
Apparently, some of these protests will continue because of the anniversary of the 1948 war surrounding Israel's creation.
Yes. That anniversary is coming up, as well as the beginning of Ramadan. That anniversary is considered a celebration on the Israeli side of this fence, but on this side, it is called Nakba. It is considered a disaster. The day that Palestinian people across the region were fleeing their homes and never to return. So it is considered a day of protest here, and if the protests today are any sign of what will happen tomorrow, they should be large and very passionate. Among the young men and boys that were in the very front of these protests, covered in smoke from burning tires and taking tear gas all day long, were also young boys that were injured. And there was lots of men with injuries on their legs, metal things on their legs holding them together, boys on crutches on the front lines because there are so many injuries in recent protests. And those same people continue to come back.
VOA Middle East correspondent Heather Murdoch reporting from the Gaza Strip. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, this is what's trending. The story that you led with today, it is everybody is sharing opinions on it, including, of course, President Donald Trump, who made the decision to move the embassy to Jerusalem. U.S. Embassy opening in Jerusalem covered live on Fox News. He always has to get a plug-in for Fox News. A great day for Israel, also later tweeting out, big day for Israel, congratulations. Mitt Romney, who was the Republican presidential candidate in 2012, had this to say. Robert Jeffress, now Mr. Jeffress is a pastor, very controversial pastor, who delivered the prayer at the opening of the embassy. Robert Jeffress says, you can't be saved by being a Jew. He said the same about Islam. Such a religious bigot should not be giving the prayer that opens the United States embassy in Jerusalem. So here you have Republicans fighting amongst themselves. You also have Democrats fighting amongst themselves. Here's Senator Bill Nelson from Florida. Today we celebrate the relocation of the U.S. embassy to its appropriate place in Jerusalem. But the hard work of helping bringing a secure and lasting peace must go on. And then on the other side, Ian Bremmer, who is a very well-known researcher, author, Middle East scholar, best week for Netanyahu in years, he writes, Iran deal over successful military strikes against Iran and Syria, U.S. embassy opens in Jerusalem, won't stop the corruption investigation. So here you have two Democrats who are of different opinion and different thoughts on this very controversial move, and I'm sure that we're going to be reading much more about this in the days to come.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. 19 people are killed in an Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. This is a key week as Europe scrambles to salvage the Iran deal. A second family stages suicide bomb attacks in Indonesia, and the new Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad removes the country's attorney general. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the chief of MI5 warns of threats from Russia and Islamic State. While preferring to work with Europe to improve the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, the White House indicated Sunday Europeans doing business with Tehran could be subject to sanctions now that the U.S. has left the accord. White House National Security Advisor John Bolton appeared Sunday on the ABC program This Week.
Well, I think the president said in his statement on Tuesday that countries that continue to deal with Iran could face U.S. sanctions. Europeans are going to face the effect of U.S. sanctions, already are, really, because much of what they'd like to sell to Iran involves U.S. technology for which the licenses will not be available. This was part of the flaw of the deal, to entice Europe and the United States into economic relations with Iran that eventually would have worked against really holding Iran accountable for violations of the deal. It's reminiscent of the saying attributed to Vladimir Lenin that the capitalist will sell us the rope with which we'll hang them. That's what's wrong with this deal. Why would any business, why would the shareholders of any business want to do business with the world's central banker of international terrorism?
But Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on the CBS program Face the Nation said the U.S. prefers to cooperate with its European allies on a new, broader Iran nuclear agreement.
President Trump and President Macron have both said we want to get a deal that's right, a bigger deal. We will be hard at that in the weeks ahead. I hope to be a central part of achieving that. It would be a wonderful thing if we could get the Europeans to do this. Fundamentally, what's happened during the time of the JCPOA was that the Iranian wealth creation fueled their malign behavior. The money that they had to go and launch missiles into Riyadh and Israel, putting Americans at risk, was provided by the economic benefits they got from the JCPOA. President Trump wants to starve them of that wealth.
The other signatories to the 2015 JCPOA, Russia, China, France, Germany, and Britain, have also indicated they intend to stay in the agreement. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javid Zarif visited Moscow Monday after stopping in Beijing as he attempts to construct what he called a clear future design for the comprehensive agreement. Cecile Shea, a non-resident fellow in global security and diplomacy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the Europeans would prefer to keep the U.S. in the JCPOA.
Because certainly the Europeans recognize that they're not going to be able to come up with anything better than this. Now, the problem for Iran is that any kind of a negotiation between the Europeans and the United States is going to result in a whole separate sanctions regime, it appears. The president tweeted today that he is looking for a way to improve Iranian behavior, not just with its nuclear program, but with its broader expressions of influence throughout the Middle East. And so what he is looking for is something more comprehensive. So that's what we're going to see over the next few months, is to see if the European powers with the U.S. can come up with some plan to keep the U.S. in the deal that will be acceptable enough to the Rouhani regime that he then will not pull out of the nuclear deal. And that's really what the challenge is going to be.
With trade tensions already high over these steel and aluminum tariffs by the U.S., could possible sanctions on European goods really affect transatlantic relations?
What we're seeing this week is that President Trump and the people around him prefer to look at problems and challenges as discrete rather than as intertwined. So we have a problem with steel. So we are going to sanction steel exporters, not realizing that that is going to have an impact on our military-to-military relationships with our strongest countries, for instance. He is trying to pressure China on trade, but then he realizes that that pressure on China on trade is going to affect his ability to work with China on issues regarding North Korea. And so now we're seeing yet again the inability of this administration to look at the totality of a policy coming back to harm them. We need our allies now, perhaps more than we've needed them in several years. But the Europeans are angry enough over the steel tariffs, the aluminum tariffs. The Japanese are obviously very upset about the steel tariffs. They were not waived on the tariffs, even though the Europeans were. And so now getting cooperation from those countries is going to be really challenging.
Cecile Shea, a non-resident fellow in global security and diplomacy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. In a rare speech to his European counterparts in Berlin, the leader of Britain's domestic spy agency warned of the threat of Russia, blaming the Kremlin for the poisoning of a former Russian spy in Britain in March. Andrew Parker spoke Monday in the first speech ever made outside Britain by a serving MI5 chief.
We're living in a period where Europe faces sustained threats and sustained hostile activity from certain states. And let me be clear, by this I don't just mean spies spying on other spies, spies following each other around at the dead of night. I mean the deliberate, targeted, malign activity intended to undermine our free, open, democratic societies, to destabilize the international rules-based system that underpins our stability, security, and prosperity.
Parker said the chief protagonist among hostile forces today is the Russian government. Former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia were poisoned last month in Salisbury, England, with a military-grade nerve agent developed by the Soviet Union in the 1970s and 80s. But Parker also warned his European counterparts of the growing threat of Islamic State militants. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say our sun has been shining for about the last 4.5 billion years. The sun is expected to have enough hydrogen fuel in its core to shine for about another 5 billion years. Along with producing solar energy, this nuclear fusion is creating helium. Once the sun runs out of hydrogen, it will start fusing the helium and begin another 5-billion-year process that will eventually result in the sun's death. The helium fusion process will cause the sun to expand and transform itself into a red giant star. According to a new study, as the red giant expands, it will lose mass and expel gas and dust, which will form a massive glowing ring called a planetary nebula. The sun will be a white dwarf by then and will eventually die. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. A koala hospital and new wildlife reserves are the focus of one of Australia's boldest plans to protect the vulnerable animal. Almost 25,000 hectares of state forest will be set aside for koalas in New South Wales state. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Koalas are officially listed as vulnerable to extinction in New South Wales. The state government is to spend $34 million on a range of measures to protect the iconic marsupial. Special reserves will be set up where the animals will be able to breed freely. The koala population in New South Wales has fallen by a quarter over the past two decades. It's estimated there are 36,000 koalas left in the state. Their numbers have also fallen in other parts of Australia. The animals face various threats, including a loss of habitat due to land clearing, attacks by dogs, bushfires, heat waves, and road accidents. A sexually transmitted disease, chlamydia, is also harming the health of many koalas. Special measures will also be put in place to help drivers avoid koalas that stray onto highways, including better signs. Tunnels and specially made bridges have also allowed wildlife to traverse roads while avoiding cars and trucks. New South Wales Environment Minister Gabrielle Upton hopes to set up a network of koala and wildlife hospitals to help injured animals.
This is so there are places that we can have resident expertise in one place, in places where we know that koala populations are present and need to be sustained and therefore increased over time. We're going to trial chlamydia vaccinations. Chlamydia is a disease that impacts them most severely on the north coast in New South Wales. There are some really practical parts of this package that address some of the roadkill hotspots. We have had some success with underpasses and overpasses in areas where they know they have core habitat. We need to ensure we have the right road signs, the right fencing.
The new koala clinic will be set up in Port Stephens, north of Sydney. It will join an existing hospital in the regional town of Port Macquarie that began treating injured marsupials in 1973. Conservationists have welcomed the new facility, but argue that the New South Wales state government's multi-million dollar plan doesn't address the number one threat to koalas, land clearing and logging. The koala lives in trees and has large furry ears, sharp claws adapted for climbing and no tail. It features in many Aboriginal stories of creation and is considered a totemic species. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador Alexander Lascaris, the Deputy Commander for Civil Military Engagement at United States Africa Command, or AFRICOM, held high-level meetings in Freetown, Sierra Leone, earlier this month as part of a series of engagements across West Africa. During the visit, Ambassador Lascaris, along with the U.S. Ambassador to Sierra Leone, Maria Brewer, met with President Julius Maada Bio to discuss key military, economic, and security-related issues. One topic of particular interest during the meeting was the need for a signed national maritime strategy to guide Sierra Leone's maritime agencies toward secure, sustainable, and profitable seas. The United States, in collaboration with the United Nations Development Program, recently funded a series of events aimed at finalizing a Sierra Leone National Maritime Strategy, a National Maritime Policy, and a framework for a whole-of-government approach to maritime security, which are now awaiting government approval. The participation of Sierra Leone's military in peacekeeping operations precipitated another fruitful discussion. The U.S. ambassadors stressed the need for Sierra Leone to focus on its forces' professional development and welfare in order to prepare peacekeepers that are disciplined, well-trained, and have strong leadership. In speaking with the new Deputy Minister of Defense, Simeon Sheriff, the U.S. delegation also offered to assist Sierra Leone in seeking out sound, economically viable options for training, equipping, and sustaining prospective peacekeeping forces. At the conclusion of his visit, Ambassador Lascaris commented that he was impressed to see how well the democratic process is working in Sierra Leone and congratulated the country for its successful elections and subsequent peaceful transfer of power. The delegation appreciated the opportunity to meet with President Bio and reiterated that the United States looks forward to its continued partnership with the government and people of Sierra Leone.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.